Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet John Lawson. Hi, John. How you doing?
Hi, Jan.
Originally from Richmond, Virginia, John Lawson studied poetry at St. Andrew's College under the tutelage of Ron Bays. He earned his master's at Virginia Commonwealth University and a doctorate in rhetoric at Northern Illinois. He teaches creative and dramatic writing at Robert Morris University and has just put out his first collection of poems entitled Generations, published by St. Andrew's College Press. John is currently working on several poetry manuscripts, including one tentatively called Loving Lesbia, Homages to Catullus, and another one entitled Bad Jesus. Okay. So you're going to start right in with some poems from your new book, which is called Generations. And congratulations on this new book, by the way.
Thank you.
Okay.
It's my first. I'm thrilled. I'm going to start with the first poem in the book. It's called Wow, My Life, I. And it's for Creeley. Wow, my life, I said, and my friend said, what? Get in the car, now. Get into the car right now and drive. This is a poem from the book called Venereal. Seen from the stern above the turning wake, the mainland's green sinks among the waves, as Susan sank from view so very long ago. One idly dreams from time to time one day she'll reappear, transported maybe on a magic shell, modest blonde tresses, half-hiding nipples the color of red coral. Still one learns to live, whatever while, with what's at hand and what's at eye. The vast horizon so far out of reach, the gulls that swoop and turn and cry, torn between temptations, the contemptible crumbs we toss them, or the infinite sky. This is called After. After the bills, after the routine work of the day, after dinner and the dishes, aprons hung behind the swinging door, after the kids' homework, their baths and bedside stories, after TV, after the solitary brushing of the teeth, ablutions while the other locks the doors, turns out the lights downstairs and comes back up, suddenly across a space now mystical, unknown, each sees a lone mysterious stranger, eyes full of that darkness, longing, pain, the kind to whom you'd offer if you had it, a cup of steaming tea, a scone, a place at your table to sit and take a breath. But there is no cup of tea, no table. All you have, the only thing that's left to surrender to this haunted stranger, is yourself. And I guess my final word on relationships, it's called climax. He lay atop her, like a twisted stick washed up on a frozen shore. Go on and finish, she said, and he said, I did. But he didn't move. At dawn, they bickered over soap. By dusk, they were there. Key West and Nome. I have a kind of fascination with the mystery of how we reproduce. It seems unreal. This is called the theory of sexual reproduction. At a distance, the collision of two bodies, taste of lip on lip, the tang of two salivas, breaths exchanged, gasping, darkly needful, probing, moaning like a midnight wind, all become improbable. That solid bodies might have ever met and so transacted, and that the mystic third should only then congeal and separate, unmesh like curds from whey, and that all then should move away, vanish from the other's touch, remembered only, if at all, as moods or sunbeams, confections spun of thinnest air. This is the stuff of childish tales and undigested drunken dreams, a doodled page from a madman's notebook, scratched upon at random, torn and tossed into a metal basket, prison green. Nothing of the kind has ever happened.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet John Lawson. He's reading some poems from his new book entitled Generations, published by St. Andrew's College Press. I'm glad you gave us the final word on relationships. I was wondering what it was, but kind of bleak. But I want to ask you about what seems like to me an interesting tension between the magical and the very, very mundane view of the world, namely relationships. So do you think that tension is something that drives your work?
Clearly, it does. I mean, I'm a child of science, and the scientific world has its magic, I suppose, but one is tempted to live in a very mundane, concrete reality. And yet, that doesn't do justice, and a lot of magic comes out of the language.
We had a line in one of your poems that you just read, and I'm probably not getting it right, but something like one learns to live whatever with what's at hand, and this idea of working with what's there is this almost utilitarian sense is also in your work, which I really like. And I keep, you know, as a listener and a reader, I feel like I keep thinking, oh, I have my finger on it, but then it changes. You know, I have my finger on what he's saying, and then it changes, which I think is good. So can you talk about sort of your writing process and how you move between these very different, I don't know if there's polarities, but very different ideas?
I'm interested by your term utilitarian, because there's a utility for me in pushing down the romantic that keeps wanting to bubble up. Lowered expectations result in an avoidance of disappointment, I suppose.
That sounds like a phrase that was taken from somewhere.
I'm desperately trying to quote somebody, I'm sure.
Okay.
But my poetry is a poetry of imitation, blatantly. I don't believe in originality. In fact, I think if I spoke in an original way, nobody would know what the hell I was talking about. I like to start with other people's work.
What do you mean, start with other people's work?
I read a lot of poetry. I think you have to write well. And I find as I read, at least when I'm reading successfully, I'm inhabiting with my ears the voice of that poet. And I walk away from that encounter speaking that language.
Sure, sure. I mean, I think all of us writers do that, but then you find your own way. But yeah, I guess I have to disagree with you about the originality piece. I mean, I do think there is original voice and original work.
In part, there's an ideological component to my position on that. I mean, I think the myth of originality ties in all too conveniently with the intellectual property nonsense that we're all being subjected to. You know, if we're all so original or if originality is so highly valued, then it makes sense, I guess, for us to pay for the right to use other people's ideas. But I really think that I'm a Darwinist at heart. I'm I believe we're apes, and we take joy in aping each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're covering a lot of different things there. I guess I'm just coming from, you know, the belief that no one ever showed up here with these combinations of A, B, and C, and on the page also that a writer can arrange and imagine in a different permutation than other people.
Now, wait a minute. Let's get this straight. Are you accusing me of originality?
I think I might be. I mean, I know you don't want to hear that. So, okay. Well, let's move to more poems. We're not going to solve this. So, right now, anyway, let's move to more poems.
Good. The next one is also from the book, and it's called Fifth of Eight, and it's to my beloved child. I wrote this when he was four. Let's see. This night, Wednesday night, as I rock you to sleep, is the fifth of eight. I tried to arrive Friday in time to see you, but the flight was late. Even big boys like you have to be in bed by eight. So, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, tonight, then tomorrow, then Friday, and last Saturday night. At Sunday's first glimmer, I'll drive to the airport. We rock in the dark, your heavy head on my shoulder. The warm weight of you rests upon me entirely. I smell your sweet breath and listen to it, counting. Friday's the seventh, tomorrow's the sixth, tonight, Wednesday night, is the fifth of eight. I saw something that haunted me in this parenthood vein, and I recorded it both in a painting and in this poem called Burying the Twins. Over to the right, the trees, completely leaved, cast deep black shadows. The grass, unruly, still cannot conceal the truth. This ground is rolling, broken as the sea, as if it might reject, throw up again the spoiled lives of the two stillborns furtively committed to its waves. The man, the owner, drags the second toward the orange hole, while mother, who lay beside her lost ones through the night, stands with front legs in the grave, her bovine will to share the journey with her calves, regardless of their destination. The tractor, gray metal, chugs its guttural satire on all things mortal, while flowers of the field, violet and yellow, riot in their ecstasy, oblivious beneath a livid sky. Behind this small tableau, the whole world, soiled, ripples toward a blue horizon. My mom did well until about a year ago, and then we had to move her out of her house, and she went precipitously downhill. And that's confronted me with a void in my life and an anxiety about filling it. This is called Motherland. It is a thought that grew and grew for years, as sure and slow as cowboys infiltrating west at first, and then the pioneers who hunted buffalo to eat and treated with the Indians and kept on moving, then the bluecoats who slaughtered all to make the plains and rugged mountains echo, empty as a bullet casing, so that this slow train might one day chug the rails all that way back from west to east, groaning, chuffing smoke until at last the weary messenger with the walrus mustache steps down from the Pullman, brushes off the dust and ash of that long journey, and leans to whisper what you always should have known. That by the time she dies, you must have found or find among these pigtails, printed dresses, scabby knees and elbows, silly gigglers, that one who will be worthy of so great a treason. One who'll grow so tall in love, hard in discipline, sacrifice, and strong of arm enough to bury her 6 feet under and bring you safely to another home, infinitely west of San Francisco. I'd like to try out a different tone on you now. Everything I've read so far has been from Generations. This is from a new manuscript I'm working on, and it consists of imitations of that tone I was talking about in Roman poets like Catullus. This is called The Mother of Battles. After months and months of marching side by side, up the sweaty hills into the blinding sun, then down, battered by the rain, then up again, lashed on by the goddamn yelling of the officers, at last to see it fall within the laughing benefaction of the gods. Your friend, your closest brother in arms, spitted like a fish on a barbed barbarian spear, writhing on an alien farmer's field, and sobbing through blood-encrusted lips, "Mama! Oh, Mama!" Now, you never can form another friendship, not like that, knowing henceforth that even the noblest man is nothing more at heart than a sack stuffed full of bloody guts, just waiting to tear open. And that Mama, Mama, oh, poor Mama, bless her soul, leaves her sons, just walks away, and never comes home again.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet John Lawson, reading his poetry. I want to ask you, John, about your new projects. You just read one poem from some new work. And I know you have a couple of manuscripts going on. Can you tell me what you're working on?
I've got almost a full manuscript finished now of imitations of the Romans. It's called Loving Lesbia, Homages to Catullus. And the nice thing about imitating the Romans is that they imitated the Greeks. So you get a chance in imitating the Romans to imitate the ancient Greeks as well, which has been fun. I've also started a couple of other manuscripts of which one is kind of reflects my very religious upbringing. Despite my, you know, lack of a religious commitment specifically, I'm infected by religious language. I overflow with it, and I'm full of the King James Bible. And so I wrestle with that, and my other collection is sort of working that through with poems, and it's called Bad Jesus.
Mm-hmm. The first project you talked about where you're imitating the Romans, what do you mean, what is the nature of the imitation, in terms of form, in terms of language?
Again, it's a kind of just marinating myself in the reading. I don't read Latin, unfortunately, so I'm reading translations and comparing them often. But a character of the Roman poets comes through, and I walk away speaking their language, and they speak through me. It's like I sit down at the page, and I'm writing Catullus. I'm writing Ovid. I'm writing Horace. Sappho has also made an appearance.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of a big claim to make, you know.
Well, I mean, of course. I mean, it's all mitigated and mediated by the fact that I'm John Lawson, you know.
and you want them to come through you, and you imagine they are, but really they're really far away and dead for many years.
The echo of between the themes of the last two poems I read kind of shows that my own obsessions, of course, are coming through.
Yeah, but your obsessions. I'll go for that. Yeah. Okay, so why don't you read a couple more of those?
Good. This is called Why the Vanquished Must Be Exterminated. When out of the heart of some deep collective fear and anger, men who love to laugh and wander bend their necks at last to march, yoked in grim lockstep, four abreast, in lines that stretch to the horizon, and to halt, form ranks, advance with interlocking shields, or simply stand beneath the frying sun, thrashed by pelting rain or sucked down to their calves in mud or snow, shoulders blistered with bearing heavy spears, strong hands grasping their swords' hilts. Then their hearts leap, and the hearts of all their fellow citizens leap high, and mighty words borne up on melodies surge in cadence with their tramping feet toward heaven, soaring like a holy tongue of flame that licks the highest towers of the enemy, blackening their fortresses, their hopes impregnable, a tongue of flame that sweeps the ground, their budding orchards and their fields of waving grain, a flame that leaves their young men dead, their old in chains, the ragged women squatting on the naked hillsides overlooking such a dreadful panorama, everything they ever knew reduced to stone and ash, while they nurse desperately the swarms of starving children with their withered teats, feeding them that stream of thin and sour milk, the festering nectar of fear distilled and deepest yellow anger. Actually, after reading that, I want to dedicate it to my old Spanish professor, Manuel Bejar, because he told me the story of his childhood during the Spanish Civil War of the lady in the neighborhood who wet-nursed all the children. It was one of their few sources of protein. They ate acorns.
Maybe you could dedicate it to her. It sounds like she did the hard work.
That's a good point. I'd like, if I could, now to move to the other manuscript I mentioned, which is Bad Jesus.
And okay.
This is the poem called Bad Jesus. When Bad Jesus comes around, he smells fresh from the shower, soaped and powdered, smiling in snow-white laundered robes that flow like bountiful forgiveness from his molten eye. He kneels to pray. I kneel down too and feel his gentle touch that disentangles the lost sheep of my spirit from the brambles. The heavens open, etc. Then he takes a seat beside me on the couch to watch football and asks me if I've got any soft drinks, any nachos or pretzels, and I'm all like, hey, you're God, right? Why don't you know already? And anyway, why can't you zap us up some snacks right here and save me a trip to the refrigerator? But when the good Jesus comes, I wake in the dark and listen to him snuffling around the cold, dead campfire searching food. And finding none, he roars and tears the thin skin of my tent with a savage paw. A grizzly bear with grisly breath, he snaps and slashes, chasing me, bitten and wounded, deep into the midnight forest. I hear him crashing through the undergrowth just inches behind me as I run, and I yell back over my shoulder, "Okay, okay, I believe, now go away!" But he keeps coming, and eventually I trip, and he holds me down and leisurely strips my carcass bit by bit. Here's another one from that volume, very short one. It's called Koan. I guess that's how you say it, K-O-A-N. 10,000 years from now, either I or the me who's entirely different from me, we'll still be pushing this mill wheel in circles, imagining how great it would feel to stop turning.
These are two really different projects that you're working on. I'm wondering, as you work on these, how do you generate poems towards a project? I know that most writers I know sit down and write sort of whatever comes out, and how do you, especially with two projects going on, how do you manage that writing process?
That's a really interesting question, and one I probably have only subconsciously looked at, so I'm glad to have the chance to spill about it. I wrote in the vein you described, just writing what comes to mind for years. And in fact, until the Roman project came up, I didn't have any coordinated project, which kind of explains why Generations is my first book after 40 years of writing. Once I started the Roman project, though, I found that having a coherent direction and body of things to be contributing to like that was actually very heuristic. I mean, it made me write and inspired me. Now I'm afraid I'm taking it a little too far, and I've actually got like half a dozen projects that
Hey, if it works for you, that's terrific. You know, everyone writes differently.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think we have time for one more.
Yeah. Well, I've got a very short one here. The morning before I found out about my father's fatal illness was my 54th birthday, or shortly thereafter, actually. But I woke up from this dream. It's called 54th Birthday. Drifting in and out of sleep, I'm seven again, snoozing in the back of our old Studebaker. My father, his youth restored, is at the wheel. I know I'm safe and heading home.
It's the poetry of John Lawson. Thank you so much.
Been a pleasure, Jan, always.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Lauren Wolf and Joseph Wilk. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody here on Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP. She had a smile that swerved, she had a smile that curved, she had a smile that swerved all over. It's all wrong, all wrong, all wrong, all wrong. She had a way. It's all